My name is Jeffrey Deskovic, Executive Director of the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice, which frees wrongfully convicted people.
Actual Innocence is a podcast that tells the stories of people who served time for crimes they did not commit. Listen to the heartbreaking true accounts of wrongfully convicted people and their journey to exoneration. Thanks so much for listening. Recent studies have shown that the human brain does not stop developing until a person is well into their 20s. And with that development comes the ability to make mature, responsible decisions. However, in 1989, in New York, a 16-year-old Jeffrey Deskovic was able to be questioned, interrogated, polygraphed, and arrested without any kind of parental or legal representation. I'm Brooke, and this is Jeff's story.
In November 1989, I was 16 years old. Life was pretty good for me. I was having my best year in school academically. I would say I kind of lived a double life in the sense that I grew up in an apartment complex in the suburbs of Westchester and Peekskill. And within that apartment complex, there were a lot of kids as well as people who lived in a nearby area. And so kind of like whatever activity I would suggest would kind of be what we would do. I mean, from playing basketball to swimming to riding bikes to stickball to a variety of other games that we even made up. Whereas in high school, that was a different set of kids, and so I wasn't as familiar with them, and so I was kind of quiet into myself, and I really didn't participate in very many organized sports. In 1989, I was a sophomore in high school.
I asked Jeff what he was doing on November 17th, 1989.
Yeah, November 17th, 1989. It was just a normal day. I went to high school, hung out with some of my friends, and I think that later on that evening I saw in a newspaper that another teenager who was a classmate of mine in two of my classes as a sophomore and one of them as a freshman, that, you know, she had been missing and that, you know, her body had been found.
15-year-old Angela Correa lived a sheltered life and was rarely able to leave the house without being accompanied by her parents or older sister. However, on this occasion, she had been taking pictures after school for her photography class. Some personal items had been found near her body, and she appeared to have been raped, beaten, and ultimately strangled to death. I asked Jeff if he had known her, beyond their in-class experiences.
I knew her name. She knew mine. I think I spoke with her a total of one or two times, and that was it. We weren't even on a high-bye basis.
I wondered what about their non-existent relationship had led the police to believe Jeff was a suspect.
Two factors led the police to consider me as a suspect. One of them is that they interviewed a lot of students from the high school, and some of them told the police that they might want to talk to me because I was quiet into myself. So that's what the police said initially attracted them to me. The other factor which they said attracted them to me was they said that my emotional reaction to the victim's death was disproportionate to what my actual relationship with her was. But really, if you look at it, I mean, that didn't really make too much sense because there hadn't been a murder in Peekskill for maybe 20 years. And this murder had really shook up the whole city to the point where free mental health services were offered to anybody in the city who wanted it. So while I was upset, so were many other people. And the other thing, too, is which kind of shook me up about it was that was really my first brush with death, you might say. So to that point in time, I mean, I thought that was, you know, death was something that happened to people after they, you know, lived a full life and were extremely old.
I asked him to describe his experience with the police. Remember, he was a 16-year-old child at the time.
So the police initially intercepted me on my way to high school. I lived across the street from the high school, and the police were able to figure out which street I was likely to take, and so they waited for me on that street. They intercepted me there on my way to high school.
As an advocate for many children, I asked if the police had called his parents after intercepting him on his way to school.
No, and mostly because they weren't really required to do that by law. I mean, in New York, if you're 16 years old and you're considered to be an adult for purposes of being able to speak to the police and waive your rights without having a parent or guardian.
He went on to describe his interaction with police.
The interaction with the police, somewhere between 5 to 8 times over the course of 6 weeks, had this weird dynamic about it, in which half the time they would speak to me as if I was a suspect, while the other half the time they would pretend as though they needed my help to solve the crime. So they would say things like, kids won't talk freely around us, they will around you, let us know if you hear any rumors. They would ask me opinion questions and then congratulate me on my opinion, would tell me to stop in from time to time. They made me the center of attention. They made me feel important.
Plain and simple, this 16-year-old child was being manipulated by the police.
They were, and I think that there was two other additional psychological dynamics at play at the same time. One of them was that my fantasy childhood career that I wanted to have is, you know, I wanted to be a police officer. So I think that this unexpected early opportunity to do this quasi-police work as part of, along with my age, is kind of how this, they were able to pull the wool over my eyes.
He wanted to be a police officer when he grew up, and the police used that to trick him.
And while a second dynamic is that I grew up in a single-parent household. My father was really never involved in my life in any aspect, and so they had this good cop, bad cop routine, and so I began to look up to the officer who was pretending to be my friend.
I asked him what led to his eventual arrest.
Eventually, they got me to agree to take a polygraph test because they told me that there was some new information they had obtained and they wanted to share that with me because that would put me in better position to be able to assist them. For them to give me that information, I would first have to take and pass a polygraph. So a help us to help you to help us type of pretzel logic. So the next day, rather than report to school, I instead went to the police station for the test. Because it was a school day, that meant that neither my mother nor my grandmother with whom I lived, they didn't call around looking for me because they thought that I was in school.
The police took Jeff to take a polygraph on a school day without notifying his guardians.
So they drove me to the town of Brewster, which is in Putnam County, whereas I was a native of Peekskill, which is in Westchester County. So then that meant that I was no longer able to leave on my own. I was dependent upon the police.
Miles from home and totally dependent on the police for his needs.
Put me in a small room. I didn't have an attorney present. I wasn't given anything to eat the entire time I was there. There were three officers there who I knew were police officers. And then there was also the polygraphist, who was a Putnam County Sheriff's investigator, and he was pretending not to be a police officer, and he was dressed as a civilian, so he never gave me my Miranda warnings.
An officer, dressed as a civilian, interrogated Jeff without Mirandizing him, or even identifying himself as a police officer.
Before beginning the polygraph examination, the polygrapher, he gave me countless cups of coffee.
Caffeine is a stimulant which affects the body's central nervous system, the functions of which are measured by the polygraph machine.
So after that, he took about 10 or 15 minutes and he pretended to dial in the machine into my body's biofeedback. And then from there, he attached me into this polygraph machine and he started to interrogate me using a lot of third-degree tactics.
A third-degree tactic is the inflicting of physical or mental pain in order to extract confessions or statements.
He did things like he raised his voice to me, he invaded my personal space, he kept asking me the same questions over and over again. And as each hour passed, you know, my fear increased in proportion to the time. Towards the end of the interrogation, that's when he said, "What do you mean you didn't do it? You just told me through the test results that you did. We just want you to verbally confirm this." So when he said that to me, that really shot my fear through the roof. And it was at that moment that the officer who was pretending to be my friend, he came in the room and he told me that the other officers were going to harm me, but that he was holding them off but couldn't do so indefinitely, that I had to help myself. Then he added that if I did as they wanted, not only would they stop what they were doing, but that I could go home afterwards being young, naive, frightened, 16, not thinking about the long-term implications, instead just being concerned with my own safety in the moment, also being totally overwhelmed emotionally and psychologically, you know, just wanting to get out of there. I plus the whole push-pull dynamic of, on one hand, introducing the possibility of harm, and on the other, throwing me this false life preserver. I made up a story based upon information which they had given me in the course of the, not just that interrogation, but my prior contact with them, and as well as things I had read in the newspaper. By the police officer's own testimony, at the end of the interrogation, I was on the floor in a fetal position. I was crying uncontrollably.
The police officer testified that he was lying on the floor in the fetal position, crying. The same child that they promised could go home if he just said he did it. As you can imagine, Jeff did not get to go home.
No, I didn't get to go home. No, needless to say, I was arrested. I was charged with a murder and rape.
I wondered at what point an attorney became involved in Jeff's case.
I met an attorney later on that night at arraignment, which is when the judge comes to the police station and he lets the suspect know what they've been arrested for. So it was a member of Legal Aid Society. Neither I nor my family had any money to hire a lawyer.
I asked how his relationship was with his attorney.
Well, he didn't communicate with my family. He just communicated with me. He wasn't willing to talk with them. He kept saying attorney-client privilege, which, you know, might have been technically legal correct, but it didn't really make much sense because, I mean, I was really a minor and, you know, a lot of these decisions and things he was talking to me about were largely above my head. But, you know, in fairness, I mean, it was even more above my mother's head as well. So it's not that she could have really added all that much anyway. But in general, though, the lawyer very rarely met with me. When he would meet with me, I would try to explain to him what had happened in the interrogation room, but he was always shutting me up. And I would try to explain to him that I was innocent. And I remember one time he told me that he didn't care whether I was guilty or innocent.
I can understand an attorney wanting to give every client a good defense, despite guilt or innocence. But when a 16-year-old boy could be in prison for the rest of his life, and he says he's innocent, his attorney should listen to him.
You know, whenever I would ask him, you know, what his strategy was, what his plans were, the gist of his response was that he was the lawyer. You know, I was just some 16-year-old kid. Just sit back and just get out of the way and let him do his job. And not having any prior experience with the law, I mean, I'd never been arrested for anything. And he had a reputation of supposedly being their legal aid's best trial lawyer, so I listened to him.
I was so engrossed in Jeff's story. I tried really hard not to use my therapist voice when I asked him, how did that make you feel?
I was very frightened, and I didn't really understand things. And then every time I went to court, it was like a major media moment, you know, with virtually all the coverage written from a guilt presumptive-oriented perspective.
He was alone, afraid, and the attorney who was supposed to be on his side barely communicated with him. He faced hordes of media personnel who had already convicted him in the press.
I was charged with murder, rape, and possession of a weapon.
I asked him what evidence the prosecution presented at trial.
They just had a coerced false confession from me. They didn't have anything else. Before the trial started, DNA tests came in from the FBI lab, which the results of which showed that the semen found on the victim didn't match me. You know, my lawyer tried to get the case against me thrown out based on that, but the courts didn't do that.
Yes, you heard him right. The semen found on the victim did not match Jeff's DNA. But the trial still proceeded.
The DNA evidence was my primary defense, but having said that, I mean, my lawyer didn't put on a defense. You know, I mean, he cross-examined witnesses, but, I mean, he didn't. There was a lot for him that he could have done, but he didn't do. Firstly, in order to explain away the DNA test result, which didn't match me, the prosecution, they elicited fraud on the part of the medical examiner. So 6 months after doing the initial autopsy and documenting all of his findings, suddenly, for the first time, he claims that he found medical evidence to show that the victim, who was 15 years old, who was living a really sheltered life, and she never went outside unless she was with her parents or her older sister. He claimed that he found medical evidence to show that she was sexually active, which is what opened the door for the prosecutor to argue that it didn't matter that the DNA didn't come from me, because it could have come from a consensual sexual encounter she had close enough to the murder and rape for us to explain away the DNA. So basically, in order to wrongfully convict me, the prosecutor was willing to trash the victim's reputation. And taking it a step further, the prosecutor also named another youth by name that he claimed that had this encounter with the victim, but he never had a DNA test result performed in order to prove that. He didn't even call him as a witness. He just made the unsupported argument to the jury.
The deceased victim's reputation was being tarnished for the purposes of a win for the prosecution. I can't imagine the despair that the victim's family must have felt at that time.
The public defender that I had was terrible. He never explained to the jury the significance of the DNA results not matching me, nor used that to argue that the so-called confession was coerced and false. When it was time to cross-examine the medical examiner, my lawyer stood up in open court and said to him, "You're going to be pleased to know that I don't have a single question for you." He should have never represented me in the first place because of a conflict of interest in that this other youth of the prosecution was falsely claiming it had this encounter with the victim. He was represented by not just another member of Legal Aid, but also by the attorney who was supposed to be supervising him on my case. So that conflict of interest prevented the defense from calling him as a witness or the defense from seeking DNA testing to explode the whole consensual sex theory. We hadn't decided if I was going to have a bench trial, which my lawyer came to me one day and he told me that the judge came to him off the record and told him to pick a jury because he didn't want to be responsible for finding me not guilty. So my lawyer was supposed to put that on the record because that statement shows prejudice and also suggests that perhaps the judge is feeling some public pressure. Then just like the semen didn't match me, there were also hairs found on the victim's body which also didn't match. So once again, the prosecutor resorted to using an improper argument. He claimed that the hairs must have come from the medical examiner and his assistant, but he didn't try to prove that. So when the hair expert learned that was the argument that the prosecutor was going to make, he told the prosecutor to give him the hair sample so that he could actually do the comparison, but the prosecutor never gave him the hairs. When that happened, my lawyer was supposed to jump on that and insist that the hairs be turned over, but he didn't.
Hairs were found on the victim's body, not belonging to the victim. The prosecutor claimed that they were from the medical examiner, but testing was never done.
I wanted to testify at the pretrial hearing. So whenever there's a confession which is used as evidence, there's a pretrial hearing that's held, and the judge has to decide whether any statements that were made voluntarily and whether the suspect was given their rights. Now, when I was interrogated at the time that coerced false confession happened, the interrogation was not videotaped. It wasn't audiotaped. There wasn't even a signed confession. It was just a police officer's word. So the cops conveniently left out the threat and false promise, which they had engaged in. So I wanted to testify at the pretrial hearing, you know, as to those two facts. But my lawyer wouldn't allow me to do that. He told me that, yeah, he hadn't decided if I was going to testify at the trial or not, and he didn't want to have me on the record as to what happened during the interrogation before that, saying that if I did take the stand at the trial, then the prosecution could use the prior testimony to cross-examine me with to make it appear as if I was lying, even if I wasn't.
There was no recorded or signed confession, only a police officer's word. So Jeff wanted to get on the stand and tell people what had really happened. But his attorney told him no.
That didn't really make any sense because, first of all, if the judge had believed me, then that means the statements would not have been able to have been used. Secondly, if it really went that badly, I didn't have to take the stand at the trial. And if I didn't, then he still wouldn't be able to use the prior testimony. But then when I got to trial, he wouldn't allow me to testify there either. He told me that it wasn't his job to prove that I was innocent. It was up to the prosecution to prove that I was guilty. And he didn't think that that had happened. I mean, that might be a legal maxim, but that's really a naive way of trying cases. I mean, the other thing which he didn't do, which I thought was really important, was he never presented my alibi. So at the day the crime happened, I was actually playing wiffle ball with a friend. If you find yourself charged with a crime that you didn't commit, you have to do everything in your power in order to try to prove your innocence, or you run a risk of possibly being wrongfully convicted.
Tragically, this reminds me greatly of the no defense of Greg Taylor's initial trial.
The sentence was 15 to life, which means that I would have to serve 15 years at a minimum, and then I could go to the parole board where I would be able to be considered for discretionary release. The life part of it means that they would never have reached a point in time where the parole board was legally obligated to release me. I was 17 at that time. I went to a men's maximum security prison.
The law tried him as an adult and sent him to a maximum security prison for men, where he would spend the next 16 years of his life.
I would describe it as an obstacle course, a nonstop obstacle course featuring the guards, civilians, and the other prisoners as all as obstacles to the main goal, which was to try to overturn the conviction and regain my freedom. It was a very dangerous place there. There was a lot of violence, stabbings, and cuttings every day. I lived in fear, really, because, I mean, I was 17 years old, maybe weighing 150 pounds, and these were fully developed men, many of whom were guilty of committing serious violent crimes. You know, and then on top of that, I wasn't just there for murder, but I was there for murder and rape. In prison, there's a vigilante mentality where people have been convicted of sex offenses. So I was always in fear that somebody would discover what I was incarcerated for, and that that would serve as a motivation on their part to assault me.
I wonder how Jeff's relationships with his mother and grandmother were affected by his time in prison.
Well, I saw them a lot less. I mean, my mother used to make the 3.5 to 4.5 hour trip a couple of times a month. But then as the years wore on, I think that the long trip kind of, you know, wore on her. And it was expensive to make the trip as well. She developed a few medical problems as far as, you know, in her back and her feet. And so I think that the cumulative impact of all of that is I began to see her less and less. At the end, maybe the last 5 or 6 years, I think I probably saw her a couple of times a year. My grandmother used to make the trip with my mother, but then she passed away while I was still wrongfully imprisoned back in 1996.
Appeals are based on arguments that there were error in the trial's procedure or errors in the judge's interpretation of the law.
I lost 7 appeals. And at that point, my appeals were exhausted. That was back in 2001. So by that point, I already had like 10 or 11 years in. Because the appeals were exhausted, then the state doesn't give you a lawyer any longer because they figure that you're not litigating anymore. So at that point, the only way to get back into court is to come up with some previously unknown evidence of innocence. So the path at that stage was that I'd have to find a lawyer to take my case for free. I didn't have any money, and to also try to find an investigator who would work similarly and hope that in tandem that they could find some previously unknown evidence of innocence. And without that, the court was no longer willing to entertain any legal challenges from me. So I wrote letters for about 4 years, very rarely getting answers.
I asked who those letters were addressed to.
I sent them to large law firms, where they had pro bono sections in it. I sent them to nonprofit organizations that worked to free wrongfully convicted prisoners. I sent them to reporters, hoping that they would dig around a little bit, write an article or two, and then my case would come to the attention of legal help that I needed. I wrote churches and other faith-based organizations, hoping that maybe somebody in their congregation might be a lawyer or an investigator, or that they might be able to raise the money for me. Basically, anybody and everybody I could possibly think of, and then some, who could help me either indirectly or directly, would be who I would write to.
Eventually, someone did answer.
Eventually, I wound up in touch with Claudia Whitman, who is an investigator who works from Colorado and Maine. And so she wrote me back right away. And she told me that my case was too far away for her to work on it, but that she had helped me with the networking. So she suggested that I write the Innocence Project, which is a nonprofit organization that frees wrongfully convicted people throughout the country in instances where DNA testing can demonstrate innocence and in which no prior testing had been conducted. So, I mean, I had wrote them back in 92, 93, but they had turned me down then because they were using DNA just as newly discovered evidence. And because the DNA had already excluded me, it wouldn't have been anything new. She suggested that I write them again in light of the advancement in DNA technology. And then in addition to my writing them, she also lobbied them from outside their organization. She also got several other respected legal entities to write letters on my behalf to them. And then at the same time, one of the intake workers who was not a lawyer, Maggie Taylor, every time the lawyers decided that they didn't want to take my case based upon the pre-existing DNA exclusion, she would go back to the drawing board and come up with a new theory as to how DNA could be used to exonerate me, and she'd re-present my case to them.
And so, finally, after years of writing letters, the Innocence Project from New York agreed to represent Jeff.
So she did that the third time doing that. She was successful. One of the ideas that carried the day was one of the ideas that I had suggested to her. So once they, their agreeing to represent me was the first most significant event that led to my exoneration. The second was that the previous Westchester District Attorney, Janine Pirro, who had fought all of my appeals and prevented me from getting further DNA testing, left office. Her successor was willing to allow me to have further testing without having to litigate over it. And the third thing was that we got lucky that the actual perpetrator had committed an additional crime for which he got caught.
While Jeff was in prison for raping and murdering a 15-year-old girl, the perpetrator was still free to commit another crime.
He killed the second victim 3.5 years later. He got caught for that crime, and as a result of that, his DNA was put into the databank so that when I was allowed to have the further testing, taking the crime scene evidence, which already didn't match me, and comparing it to that databank, it matched him. And he subsequently confessed both to the police as well as a reporter on video camera.
What you're about to hear is a clip of Stephen Cunningham confessing to the murder of Angela Correa, the 15-year-old victim.
How did you end up killing her?
Strangling.
Was it during the sex? Was it after the sex?
Yeah, it was during, and like a rage.
What did she do? We talk about the cocaine makes you aggressive, but what did she do that put you into that rage?
Nothing at all.
Stephen Cunningham, who was already spending time in prison for strangling his girlfriend's sister, pled guilty to Angela Correa's murder and is now serving 20 to life in the Eastern Correctional Facility, a maximum security prison.
So in September 2006, my conviction was overturned and I was released. On November 2nd, 2006, the charges against me were dismissed on actual innocence grounds, whereas he was ultimately arrested and convicted for the crime.
After spending his entire adult life in prison, Jeff was declared actually innocent, and I asked how he felt in that moment, the moment when he knew he was free.
That moment happened in the courtroom when the conviction was overturned, and I got up to leave, and then just suddenly kind of the enormity of the moment hit me, kind of like a ton of bricks, and I had to sit back down, and it took maybe like 20 minutes for me to be ready to get up and leave. But it really seemed very surreal. It didn't seem very believable. In fact, that was my first words at a press conference. I said, is this really happening?
What does a person do in their first days of freedom as an adult?
Well, we had a celebration meal at an Italian restaurant. And then after that, I spent a couple of days at my aunt's house. And then I went to the town where my mother lived. And I was there for a couple of days. And then a mother who had I had played with her son when I was a kid, she sent me $100 and to get a train ticket. So I packed a little bit of stuff up that I had, and I went on the train, and I went back to Peekskill, and my idea, my goal was to just visit a bunch of different people until I could figure out, you know, a way to stay down there. I mean, the town that my mother was living in, Kolbuskill, was very rural, and so there really wasn't any opportunity for me to try to restart my life up there.
How do you pay bills, apply for jobs, spend your money? I know I do all of those things online, and I have since the late 90s. It feels natural to me, but for Jeff, those things had all developed while he was locked away. He had to learn a new way of completing everyday tasks.
Yeah, so things were very difficult. I mean, there were psychological after effects. The technology was different. We didn't have internet, cell phones, GPS, these, you know, different methods of banking. Culture was different. When I would visit with members of my extended family, I mean, it was kind of awkward. I mean, I knew who they were from having memories of them from when I was younger, but then, you know, they were different people now, as was I. You know, there was after effects of my experience, and then I wasn't able to obtain gainful employment. I didn't have the same level of job experience as other applicants. I mean, I very nearly ended up into a homeless shelter. And, you know, if I had to travel someplace, you know, I'd put cereal in a bowl and carry it around with me in a backpack. I mean, there were a lot of struggles.
Basically, Jeff was a stranger to modern day social interactions and had lost the ability to build a resume while in prison. He was almost homeless and carried food around with him because he had no extra money to buy food while he was on the go. I asked him if he was offered any educational experiences in prison.
Yeah, I was. And so I got the GED, I got the associates, and I got another year of schooling towards the bachelor's, but then the funding was cut. And then when that happened, I did a lot of the vocational trades. But although I finished a lot of the trades, I mean, a lot of the curriculum that I learned was really obsolete because I finished the plumbing class, and like nearly all the training was in metal pipe. And, you know, today it's you know, PVC pipe and copper, so the training was really useless.
Since that time, Jeff has started down the road of advocating for others. I asked him what led him from the almost homeless man he was to the person he is now.
So what led to that was I saw where there were gaps even within the innocence movement. I mean, most of the organizations that free wrongfully convicted people, they will only take on a case if there's DNA and available, and that's only 5 to 12%. Many people with credible innocence claims whose cases could be won would normally be turned down because they required on the ground investigative work. Then on top of that, there's a policy portion of it where we try to get changes in the law that are designed to prevent wrongful convictions. But again, some of the advocacy things that I push for are not things that they're not mainstream innocence issues that the majority of the organizations in the field are pushing for. And then also I recognize the difficulty in rebuilding one's life, and so having a reintegrative component was important. So seeing those gaps in the system, and then when I was able to receive some financial compensation, that's when I wanted to take my advocacy work to the next level. I mean, as an individual advocate, when I was released, I was a columnist for 5 years at a weekly newspaper where I wrote about wrongful conviction issues. And then there was I did a lot of presentations around the country, and I did a lot of media interviews, and, you know, basically trading privacy in exchange for awareness. And I was meeting with elected officials and testifying at legislative hearings where they were considering measures. But I did that as an individual advocate. I mean, I wasn't able to do the reintegrative work, and I certainly wasn't able to exonerate anybody. So when I found myself in possession of some financial compensation, I wanted to ratchet things up to the next level. So hence starting the organization.
Jeff was compensated, monetarily, for his lost time. And he used that money to start his own organization to help the wrongly convicted.
So the things that make us unique are that, well, firstly, we do both DNA and non-DNA cases. We advocate for policy positions that most of the other organizations are silent about. We utilize parole as a stopgap measure. So if any of our clients come up for parole, we send a letter on their behalf to the parole board outlining the primary and secondary reasons why we think that they're innocent, and we urge the parole board to release them. We have the short-term housing. And lastly, we're the only organization that was started by an exoneree who used some of their compensation to start the organization that has an exonerative component to it. So in the 4 years of our existence, we exonerated two people. We exonerated William Lopez, who was incarcerated for 23 and a half years prior to us assisting his attorneys and helping him get exonerated. We exonerated William Hall, who was in for 8 years and 4 months on an arson case that wasn't actually an arson.
William Lopez and William Haughey were both exonerated by Jeffrey Deskovic's organization. I asked him if having the name of William was a requirement.
Yeah, it's kind of unusual that it worked out that way, that their names were both William, and that, we used the more affectionate nickname of Bill.
He went on to talk about the other accomplishments that his organization has achieved in their past 4 years of existence.
Persuaded the parole board to release three different people on innocence grounds, and we helped four exonerees reintegrate back into society. Then we have another client, Hector Lopez, again, no relation to the other two, which ironically also is another arson case that, you know, is very suspicious, which, you know, has some troubling characters in it, unusual human interest, fun fact, that's just a coincidence.
I asked Jeff what advice he might have for people who found themselves in a similar predicament to his.
Definitely don't quit. If I had quit, I would never, I wouldn't be out here now. I would encourage them to adopt the same tactics I adopted, which was definitely go to the law library and learn the law. That's very important. Read wrongful conviction literature. I mean, that used to serve as inspiration for me, encourage me to keep going. And yeah, I would encourage them to continue to write to as many different people trying to obtain representation. And you can't go one place at a time. You have to take more of a gangplank approach. And, you know, whoever commits to your case first would be who I would suggest going with. I would suggest reading nonfiction books. I mean, I feel like it was when I wasn't doing legal work, it was important to do something that was productive, and I really feel like I expanded my mind and learned. There are a few nonprofit organizations within prisons itself that offer college education. There's Bard College, and there's also Hudson Link. So to the extent that people that are in my position might be in the facilities where that's offered, because it's not in all the prisons. I would definitely advise them to get as much college education as they can. I mean, that really helped me a lot, to the extent that I had that much less ground to cover educationally when I was released. So since I've been home, I was able to complete the bachelor's degree. I also have a master's degree from John Jay College, where my thesis was written on wrongful conviction causes and reforms. And then in this September, I'm going to be attending Pace Law School.
How amazing is that? He went from a 16-year-old boy to a man in his 30s while wrongly convicted. And now he's starting law school. I asked how people could support his foundation and the work they're doing, and how they can help wrongly convicted people in general.
In order to free people, that's not a free thing to do. I mean, we offer the service free, but obviously the attorneys, paralegals, and investigators, and other essential personnel, they're not like independently wealthy, so they have to have a salary. So one thing is just definitely there's financial support that's needed. So the foundation, we have a campaign on a website. Patreon, and so it's for people that are willing to be recurring monthly donors. So what we're trying to do is get as many people as we can who are willing to commit a small amount of money, even if it's just on a $3 or $5 level, but on a regular basis. We're trying to get a lot of people to commit to that, so that if we get 25,000 people who can commit to that, then that would give us a $900,000 a year budget, which would enable us to hire additional lawyers, paralegals, investigators, so we can free more people so that they don't all have the first name of William. Also helping spread the word amongst their friends and family. I mean, I really feel like there's a misconception that, people have to be wealthy or upper middle class in order to make a contribution. I mean, again, even if it's down on a small minor level, it's all helpful. People who can help spread the word of that campaign, and there's also people that write blogs or use social media. Those things all count. Perhaps there is a skill. We have the foundation. We accept volunteers. We accept interns. There's, a number of things that we need that people could help out with that way. Businesses are able to help us through donating in-kind services. We are a 501c3 organization, and so they can assign a dollar value to what the services are, and they could definitely get a tax write-off for that. That would be very helpful. And just, I encourage people to learn more about wrongful convictions, share that information with their friends and family. I think that most people really don't understand what the different ways that the justice system is broken. And also, I mean, most people would be shocked if they learned, for example, that it wouldn't be unusual if one public defender was assigned to represent 100 people at the same time. I don't think that most people realize that, the prosecutors have immunity. So no matter how serious the misconduct is, they don't face any criminal penalties. You can't sue them civilly. So hence the need, we're pushing a bill which would create a commission on prosecutor conduct. That's Senate Bill 24, Assembly Bill 1130. So learning about deficiencies like that, and then sharing that information. I would encourage people to consider a career in the innocence movement. There's a wide variety of careers. I mean, obviously there's attorney and investigator, but there's room for people to do policy work. There's public relational positions. There's social worker and psychologists on dealing with the back end of things in terms of helping exonerates reintegrate. There's paralegal. There's people doing, you can do social media or things pertaining to websites. There's a lot of different ways to get involved, whether that's on a career level, which I definitely want to encourage people to do, but then also on a volunteer or donor level.
And if someone wanted to donate time or a service, where should they go?
Yeah, they would go to our website, www.deskovic.org, and from there they can email me through the foundation's website. Just to add a couple more things, I mean, definitely we're trying to make the Patreon campaign go viral, so maybe people have a skill even in making short videos or things like that. I mean, there's limitless possibilities in all the ways that people can can help us. It's only limited to their imagination and to mine. So I'm definitely open to all types of assistance, both conventional as well as outside of the box. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, it's all linked together, broad phrase of battling wrongful conviction. So in that context, some unusual things could be considered to be advocacy work, but yet, you know, it all counts. Yeah, I just wanted to share that this isn't something that just, you know, happens to a particular race or to cuts across not just racial but socioeconomic status, and it doesn't really matter what walk of life. I mean, you know, wrongful convictions can happen to anybody. In my situation, I was a white kid from the suburbs. Imagine how many, if it happened to me, imagine how many people from a minority community this could happen to. I did not have a criminal record. I had never been arrested for anything. I was not a high school dropout. I was actually on my way to high school at the time I was initially intercepted by the police. So, I mean, it happened to me, yeah, and it can happen to anyone.
At the end of the interview, I always ask if there's anything I didn't ask that the interviewee would like to share.
I want to just one more time just share for our listeners just the website URL for the Foundation's Patreon campaign. It's www.patreon, that's patreon.com/Deskovic, that's DESKOVIC. We do post to the wall there what, you know, the work is, that so people understand what their dollars are going to. I want to share with people that, you know, I personally work anywhere from, you know, 55 to 65 hours a week. Sometimes it gets to 70. You know, I don't get paid for this, but, you know, it's the purpose of it's not to put money in my pocket. It's to hire personnel because to free people who are wrongfully convicted. I mean, just to give some context, there was a recent Wayne State University study that stated that 10,000 people were wrongfully convicted each year. Last year, 149 people were exonerated. Then in 2014, 139 people made it out. 2012 and 2013, 91 people in each year were exonerated. So wrongful convictions are not rare. You know, that fact is what keeps me up at night. That's what keeps me doing this work, is I know that there's a lot of men and women that I metaphorically left behind. And I can't forget about the experience that I had. And now that I find myself unexpectedly free and, you know, having some resources, I mean, I'm taking all the steps that I can on my behalf in order to try to free them, in order to try to be the person I wish I had when I was on the inside. But despite all my efforts, though, I'm still just one person. I don't have unlimited resources, and, you know, I need the public's assistance on all levels. And so, I just hope that this cause can move people enough to take some action. I mean, if we all do a little bit, I think we can get a lot of things done.
This is Brooke. Thanks for listening. The Actual Innocence Podcast website is www.actualinpod.com. That's actualinpod.com. Share your feedback and questions by emailing actualinnocencepod@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter @actualinpod. Please show your support by rating us and giving us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast app, or by becoming one of our Patreon sponsors by clicking the support link on our website. Remember, sharing this podcast and the stories of those who have been exonerated help to fix our criminal justice system. I'm Brooke. Thanks for listening.